You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. It's been said that education is the great equalizer in our society. Yet we know that far too few young people of great talent and promise attend highly selective colleges and universities. We also know that people who do attend such institutions, and this is why this is an important issue, achieve somewhere between a $200,000 to $500,000 increase in earnings over their lifetime. To discuss this issue with me today is our guest, Dan Porterfield, who has spent many years in the higher education space and has pioneered solutions to help young people of promise attend and prosper in such institutions. Dan is also the CEO of the Aspen Institute. And during this two-part interview, this is part one, we'll have an opportunity to discuss higher education access and also Dan's career, how he got into it, how he got started in it, what drives him every day, and also the great work of the Aspen Institute.
Thank you, Art. It's great to be with you.
Well, always great to be with you. Just to give my guests some context and fair warning, I've known Dan Porterfield since, I want to say, around 2011.
We met in September 2010, to be exact, at a Marriott hotel in the Philadelphia airport.
Oh, is that right? Okay. There you go. I'll never forget that day because we were interviewing for the next president of Franklin and Marshall College. I happen to be a trustee there and a member of the search committee. And in walks this guy from Georgetown, who I was immediately impressed with after he began talking about his experience and his passion for education and for giving people from disadvantaged backgrounds access to great institutions. And to Franklin and Marshall's great credit, we made the hire and got Dan to Lancaster. And the rest is sort of history. But I was impressed also, Dan, with your background. And what was it that drove you to a career focused on education in particular? I know you grew up in Baltimore. What was it about your early life that sort of triggered a career in education?
Well, thank you, Art. And it's such a pleasure to be with you on the Heart of Giving podcast. And there were a couple different factors brought me into education from the very early in my life. The first is that my mom was a single mother who was working in the day and going to college at night while raising me and my sister, Kate. And so I was exposed to the passion that she had for continued adult learning at a time when she had so much else on her plate trying to make ends meet for me and my sister. That was a big influence. And I think I got my sixth grade degree at the same time she in her 30s got her college degree from then Towson State College, now Towson University. And then like other single mothers, every time she got a degree, she was looking for the next one. And so she went from being a undergraduate at Towson to a master's degree student in history at Towson while also teaching in the day. And she was so good that she then was offered a position in the doctoral program at University of Maryland, where she got her PhD in history. And she got that degree when she was in her 40s, and I was then a student at Georgetown University. And so the big influence of my life in terms of understanding the power of education to allow a person to develop the greatness that's inside of them came from watching my mom labor joyfully for more than a decade to get her undergraduate, master's, and PhD degree. And then the dissertation that she developed at the University of Maryland was on a topic that was novel and was viewed by some as not history even. It was about the story of prostitutes in the American West, the making of the outward move of the country all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And as people went out looking for oil and starting, or gas or whatever, and starting small towns, one of the first things they did was trafficked women out to be on the frontier. And, you know, looking back, what that story tells us is that when a person from a modest economic background or from a marginalized community gets an opportunity to pursue education all the way to the top of their aspiration, inevitably they will bring a perspective into scholarship that didn't exist before that person's ascent. And in my mom's case, she helped to remake the very definition of American history. She went on to write other books about women prisoners in the American West and about the lives of homemakers in the American West and nuns in the American West. And I have to believe that all of the scholarship she contributed to this, the story of American history, has inspired other women from underrepresented backgrounds to make their contributions to the evolving understanding of what it really is, the American experience in its fullness. The other thing that made a big difference in my upbringing and my love for education was that I had great teachers in elementary school at Northwood Elementary School in Baltimore and then at St. Paul's School and Loyola High School in Baltimore, who saw me as an individual and helped me to develop a growth mindset, the belief that I could learn, and who encouraged me to bring my values into education in all different, any way I could. And I think that idea of being seen and heard and valued by people that we respect when we're young can be tremendously motivating to believe in education. And then finally, when I was both in high school and at Georgetown as a younger person, I worked in a hands-on way to develop programs that helped low-income students pursue educational opportunity and to have kind of big brothers and big sisters who would accompany them on their own journey. Partly I did that through creating integrated basketball teams in Baltimore that played in all white or all black leagues. I also worked with court supervised youth in Washington, D.C., and then with recently arrived immigrants in Washington, D.C. And from all of that, all that hands-on direct experience, trying to activate among young people their motivation and drive to see education as a pathway for a life they would like to lead, I became convinced that was what my calling was to do that for my career.
Wow, I can certainly see how formative all of that was for you. And growing up in Baltimore, you obviously had a chance to see disparity at play. And I'm certain that for someone like you, you saw maybe that there could be opportunities if we could eliminate some of those disparities, particularly around education, who went to what school and how we can make schools great and how do we find ways to create new opportunities for kids that didn't exist.
Definitely. My dad was a public school teacher in Baltimore for 40 years, and I often went into his classrooms in schools that included Western High School, a girls' school, Canton High School, Canton Middle School, Chinkapin Middle School. And so I was able to see firsthand the hope that was contained within the students and the families and the teachers in those schools, and also some of the disparities just in terms of the lack of resources. I also had the experience of growing up in two different kinds of neighborhoods in Baltimore. When I was little, we lived in a neighborhood where we were pretty much the only white family, as I remember. My dad was driving a taxi. He hadn't even started teaching yet and was writing plays. My mom was at home. And we lived in that neighborhood for a couple of years. I just kind of remember it as where we lived, running around playing with kids, going to school. And then in 1968 or 69, my father's mother passed away, and my parents divorced, and we moved into a white working class neighborhood that was about a mile away from where we had been living. And that neighborhood was all white. And my mom was a single mom with her kids. Most of the people that lived there worked at McCormick Spices or Black & Decker, maybe Baltimore City Police, and Sparrows Point. It was a working class neighborhood. The people in that neighborhood bought these row houses themselves. It was their first homes, their only homes. And that seemed like kind of like a neighborhood where, like just growing up, I didn't think about it much. Just, played baseball and football and basketball and ran around with kids in the neighborhood. It was all white, though. And I only began to think about race in that context. First, when I went to school, because I went to the local public school, which was integrated, but the kids in this neighborhood all went to a local Catholic school that was all white. I didn't really make the connection that the Catholic school was all white in the neighborhood, and that's where the whole neighborhood went, except for me. But then, I forget how old I was, 11 maybe, when the first family that was not white moved in. They were African. The father was a doctor, and there were, I think, two little girls. And a number of people in the neighborhood were hostile and shouted things and wrote on their sidewalk and just tried to harass them into leaving. I remember my mom going up and bringing a casserole to the family and getting to know them and setting a very different example. Well, pretty quickly, the people in that neighborhood started moving out, or at least some of them did. Maybe a third to a half moved out within 6 months. A lot of them were the, families of kids. Wow. I played with and like knew and stuff, played touch football with or roller hockey. And a lot of them moved, but a lot of them didn't. And the neighborhood today remains an integrated neighborhood in Baltimore and, is a good place. And what I seeing directly sort of racial hatred and animosity, fear, and then white flight directly, seeing that helped me to understand how deep and destructive racism really is. And it also, my mother gave me an example of a positive way to live. She told me that when she went up to meet the family, and then we became friends with lots of other new families that moved into the neighborhood, she basically said that anyone that has the life experience of growing up white will have to think about what kind of a person they are going to be, what kind of a way they are going to be white. And you could almost think that she was way ahead of her time. Because she had no advantages. She grew up in foster care. She had a single mom and she put herself to school. But she understood that even with her own struggles, it was incumbent upon her to understand and reach out to members of the African-American community because of the different social constraints, restrictions, prejudices that community would have to deal with. And that we as people who were white should not be neutral about that. So that's quite a life lesson. I think that young people often get exposed to very positive and very negative messages when we are young. We absorb them almost by osmosis. We have to unlearn some of the things that we are taught or hear or the culture tells us that are actually destructive. But we also have to cling to and live those values that role models give us, whether we get them from our parents or from sports or from school, and make sure that we try to carry ourselves consistent as adults with the way the adults we admired taught us to carry ourselves.
Wow, that's quite a story and a background, Dan. And I have to say that I didn't plan that this interview would go in the direction of race, but it's kind of hard to talk about education in this country unless you talk about race to some extent.
Exactly.
Many of the people who are lacking in access to some of our most selective colleges and universities are people of color. not only people of color, as we found out, but there's also been a lot of work done, and you've been leading a lot of that work to try to change that. One of the big initiatives may have started when you were president at Franklin and Marshall. Why don't you tell some of our guests about some of the work we did there?
Well, thank you, Art. And of course, you were very much a part of that work as a trustee of the institution. And as an alum who was a role model for students, faculty, and other alum alike. So when I was at Georgetown, I worked closely with President Jack DeJoy and others on all kinds of projects and initiatives to help Georgetown live its identity as a Jesuit institution to try to promote a better world. One of the ways we did that was by building a financial aid program that was strong enough that Georgetown could admit students without looking at their financial background and then meet their full demonstrated financial need. And that was pretty challenging for Georgetown to sustain fiscally, but it's been able to all these decades. And it was probably the critical strategic gesture that allowed Georgetown to rise from a regional institution competing with other regional schools to a national institution, because it attracted a national student body and a base of talent that then caused the whole educational experience for all students to rise. Financial aid at Georgetown directly related to the institution's growing academic excellence. This is true of almost all the major schools that have big financial aid programs. And so when I came to Franklin and Marshall College, it was at a time when a consensus was starting to develop among faculty, trustees, senior colleagues, that F&M could and should invest much more in its financial aid program. And during the years when I was there, we tripled our financial aid budget. We committed to our students that we would meet their full demonstrated financial need with a financial aid package that was predominantly grant, but it could also include a modest loan and some work study opportunity. And then we would go out and recruit students affirmatively from all around the country, from a much wider array of schools, neighborhoods, communities, regions than the school had traditionally when it kind of grew up as a school focusing on East Coast students to great success. Well, when we developed what we called our talent strategy, the combination of aid plus recruitment plus then partnering with students to create, you know, great learning experiences, the faculty and the students at the school really began to get excited. And that's because by investing in our need-based financial aid program, we were able pretty quickly to triple the percentage of low-income students in the school, which meant more or less tripling African-American students, immigrant students, rural white students, Latino students. Everything tripled. And as we were tripling, the academic performance of the student body as a whole was getting stronger and stronger in terms of student retention, grades. And then extraordinarily, we began to see that our low-income students were outperforming upper-income students as the highest GPA earners and winners of prestigious scholarships. And that all happened fast. It happened fast mainly because this country has millions of very talented students in every community and every zip code. And if the top colleges can get into those schools and communities, build trusting relationships, and offer admission packages that meet the students' financial needs, the learning will pretty much take care of itself. There's always more to do to create an environment that facilitates student belonging. But bottom line, if top schools put their money in financial aid and go out and recruit talent, there will be benefits to all students in the school as a whole. And so that was the F&M story. And then supported by our board and others, we then partnered with Bloomberg Philanthropies to create the American Talent Initiative, through which now more than 130 highly selective colleges and universities have together committed to sort of joining the F&M project of increasing enrollment of Pell Grant students in their schools. And the goal of our collective is to increase by 50,000 the number of Pell Grant students enrolled in any high graduation rate school. We're defining that as 70% or higher by the year 2025. And that project was really on track with a fast gains of about 20,000 across all these top schools. The whole Ivy League is in it, all these different great liberal arts institutions like F&M and Carleton and Swarthmore and Williams and Amherst, they're all in it. Big public flagships like UT Austin, the UC system, the University of Maryland, Ohio State, University of Michigan, they're all in it. And we made a lot of progress the first couple of years. COVID has clearly knocked the progress back. We've seen across most of our top schools that a lot of low-income students have taken gap years in the middle of their education in order to be at home with their families and take care of their parents or their little siblings or work. We need to get those kids back on college campuses this fall. And secondly, the applications are down in a variety of categories, or were down in a variety of categories, but the biggest drop across the country has been low-income students applying to college. So for me, the story of American higher education system is that it either will or will not contribute to authentically to the notion of the meritocracy and of democracy. And the first point is that if you have talent and use your talent and pursue your dreams, you should rise in this country. You should get more educational opportunity. And the second point, democracy, is that the only way this country can fulfill its promise is if every student and every community have equal educational opportunity. The American Talent Initiative is just one effort, and it's hardly, it's the tip of the iceberg, hardly the only thing that matters. But for the country as a whole, for our future in a global economy, for our future as a democracy, we have got to get equity and equality of education across the board from preschool all the way through the PhD.
Dan, you're out of higher ed right now at the Aspen Institute, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I do have to ask you about this slide back as a result of COVID. And what do you think colleges and universities will need to do now, particularly ones that have suffered financially as a result of COVID, to keep this initiative going and strong and to provide these opportunities for young people and access? How do we do it financially, Dan? I think that's what maybe a lot of colleges are struggling with.
Yeah.
What are some of the trade-offs that colleges have to deal with in order to make this work?
Thank you, Art. There's a lot our colleges need to do. First, they've got to make sure that the low-income students in their student body stay on track to a degree. And a lot of students have taken gap years. We cannot afford to have significant numbers of low-income students in this generation having debt but no degree. So keep the students on progress to degree. Secondly, if any university or college finds it is losing the percentages of low-income students or African-American or Latino or rural students in the student body, they need to take steps to reestablish an upward trajectory of those cohorts, because those cohorts are, in fact, the growing cohorts of teenagers in our country. The population of the country is becoming, is more and more coming from lower income communities, more and more coming from minority communities. So any school that sees its percentages dropping because of COVID, you know, may say understandably, well, it's not our fault, but it's your problem. You have to reverse those losses. That then leads to questions of financial viability and trade-offs. So what do you do? One possibility is you look at all the different levers that you have within your financial model and see which ones you can pull to generate the revenue you need to fund financial aid. What could they be? One, restructuring debt in order to lower debt payments and have them stretch out more over time. Two, increasing enrollment in order to generate more partial or full payers, and it's probably partial payers. Three, look at some of the ways that money is spent and make decisions to spend less or to spend down on features of an academic environment that are valuable, but in the immediate moment are not as valuable as financial aid. That might mean putting certain kinds of hires on hold, or it might mean reducing expenditures on aspects of an academic environment like the co-curricular learning. It could mean delaying construction projects, all perhaps painful, but necessary in order to avoid losing momentum in educating the rising generations in the country. Finally, all of our colleges and universities should be advocating for their donors to invest in people and student financial aid, because the investment in people is the investment in the school's 60-year future, because those financially aided students are the alumni and alumni of tomorrow. And we should all be calling upon the federal government to act upon proposals that many in higher education have been calling for a while, to double the Pell Grant from effectively $6,000 or so per student to at least $12,000 per student. That would have a significant salutary effect on our college's efforts not to lose ground in educating talented low-income students.
Terrific. So, Dan, let me ask you if you think that how colleges are ranked and rated has a negative or positive effect on how colleges actually structure their financial affairs and operations.
Although I think that the ratings are really detrimental to the efforts of some institutions to promote equity of opportunity for low-income students. They also have other downsides. But on that point, some of the rankings, for example, give credit to schools for spending more money on education, the theory being the more you spend, the better the education. That's laughable. But even if you accept that logic, those ranking systems then don't count student financial aid as an educational expense. Meaning, if you do what F&M did and triple your need-based financial aid budget, you actually get no credit in the academic rankings. Where if you had gone out and spent the money on things you don't need, maybe, you would, but they were called academic, you would have gone up in the rankings. Secondly, at least up until this last year, the rankings have treated the SAT as the gold standard in evaluating student talent, even though the College Board itself, which runs the SAT, says that the SAT should not be thought of as a predictive measure for college success. And even as we know from all sorts of research, from Claude Steele onward, that there are all kinds of barriers and obstacles that low-income students and students from members of minority groups face in taking the high-stakes SAT. And yet many of the rankings treat that as the benchmark of the, quote, quality of the student body. And another way of thinking about it is that in the mania to rank, what happens is that the ranking regimes create a deeply conservative mindset among college administrators and boards, which is that any innovation that would have the effect of lowering the institution's ranking because the money is spent differently would be viewed as a black mark on the reputation of the school. And that actually gets in the way of everything we know from the American private sector, which is that investing in innovation is really the way that a business retains its viability and its relevance for a changing population. And yet the ranking regimes sort of promote the exact opposite.
Well, you've had at least two, maybe three daughters now attend college. And I guess the question is, so how do parents and families make this tough decision? I mean, if you just look at the rankings, maybe you could even be misled about the quality and the innovation going on in the school. So how should parents deal with these ratings and rankings?
I think the most important thing is to give a student the opportunity to get exposed to a lot of different college options, to visit a variety of schools, to talk to students at those schools who came from their high schools or neighborhoods, to absorb a really critical point. And that point is that your education depends on you. It depends more on you than on the school you go to. Each person has the power to create the education they seek wherever they go to college, with their hard work, their optimism, Their willingness to try new things, their willingness to get to know professors and other students. Each person has that power. I am convinced that it doesn't matter a ton whether a person goes to Williams or Amherst or Davidson or Rhodes College or Pomona College or Oberlin College or Franklin and Marshall College or Trinity College. These are all liberal arts institutions that provide an individualized education. What does matter is that whichever of those schools one goes to, that the student pursue their education actively and creatively, and not just be sitting back passive, living by anti-friction, not making anything happen. I've taught in prisons, and some of the best students I ever taught were the students that I met in classes at the Maryland House of Corrections in Jessup, Maryland, and at Lorton Reformatory, the former D.C. prison that was based in Virginia. And why were those such great students? Because the men I taught had the guts to get up every day and go into a little room to engage with texts and each other and the professor in such a way as to promote their own learning, even at the cost of pain, because their learning required them to remember where they were sitting and what had happened that brought them into that place where they then decided to activate their minds. And if people's work that I taught in prison can take that mindset, that they are responsible for their learning, then so too, we who are parents of children that have every opportunity can make sure our kids don't get locked into a mindset that somehow your education is a product of which hard to get into school takes you, but rather is what do you choose to do with your intensity and your purpose to create your one college education.
So there you have it. That answer certainly would help any family work through the maze of college opportunities that their student has. It's not only college, though, Dan.
And by the way, it doesn't. Well, I do want to say something. There are different types of schools. Yeah. So some student may feel drawn to an historically Black institution. Some student may feel drawn to a big research institution that has 20,000 students. And some may feel drawn to a smaller, more intimate institution where they'll know many professors their first semester and be known by name. I do think that it matters what type of institution one is going to, but then within those categories, the differences are far less significant than the real difference, which is how much motivation does a student bring to create their learning.
Great. So, Dan, there's a debate that has continued in our society about college and its ability to push people into high paying and great jobs. And colleges have been criticized recently because some feel that they aren't, let's say, technical enough to actually produce job ready people. What do you have to say about that? You know, we're both kind of liberal arts people. We've sort of made livelihoods, yeah, even though we've had those educations. But people seem to be more concerned now, yeah, about what happens to their kids once they graduate.
Yeah, that's fair and it's understandable. I encourage parents to take the long view. There's nothing wrong with learning skills that one can put to good use in a first job. But hopefully the student is developing a mindset for lifelong learning and lifelong creativity that will carry them through into their second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth jobs. And it also, hopefully, as every job we know of gets disrupted by technologies like artificial intelligence, that our college graduates have the intellectual agility to adapt to a new way that the same job must be done because of change. Third, I would say that I like to think of a great education as a kind of like a stock or a big bank account that has interest. It keeps growing. And so if you have an education that prepares you to do something technical, but that technical skill becomes outdated, becomes obsolete, it's as if the bank, your account has been depleted. If, however, you have developed an education that allows you to keep adapting and keep succeeding as the work becomes less technical and more sophisticated, which is what happens with every promotion, then your education is like the compound interest of a bank account, more valuable 10 years later because of how it positioned you than it was when you started it with it. I think that the supposedly useless liberal arts education has incredible power to help students develop knowledge, skills, mindsets for lifelong learning, and that lifelong learning is absolutely essential in today's exponentially changing knowledge-based global economy, where almost everything that can be mechanized will be done by machines, but human talent, human intelligence will be needed and will be rewarded by those that have it.
Dan, you've given us a lot to think about in this episode as relates to college access. In our next episode, I want to have you talk with us about the important work going on at the Aspen Institute that is in so many ways enriching our lives. This is the Heart of Giving podcast. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll tune in for our next episode with Dan Porterfield. You can find us on all major podcast platforms. Please take time to listen and subscribe.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.